Hello, and welcome to Brain Food. My name is Alex, and I am in the studio today with Sandra from DPTV. I'll let her tell everyone a little bit more about herself, so if she wants to just introduce herself real quick.
Sure. Thanks, Alex. My name is Sandra Swoboda. I'm the program director for the Great Lakes Now initiative at Detroit Public Television. We're housed at Detroit Public Television, but we're a regional initiative building a network of PBS affiliates around eight states and Canada, and we're telling the stories about the Great Lakes. We have a website called Great Lakes Now where you can find daily news and information about the lakes, about the science, about the politics,
and you can also find our show. We do a monthly magazine-style TV show there where you can see all kinds of different segments and news about the lakes. All right, so if you are interested in hearing me and Sandra chit-chat a little bit today, stay tuned after this quick intro. Welcome back. So I was approached by our faculty advisor, or rather community advisor, Malcolm, about having Sandra on my show because I've expressed interest in a lot of, as you guys know, environmental issues, science issues, and really science literacy as a whole in our state. And since Sandra is heavily involved in a very science-heavy initiative with Detroit Public TV, I thought it would be awesome to have her on and chit-chat a little bit about what she does to promote science literacy in the state. But if you guys didn't know, I'm interested in science communication, even though I'm not a communication or English or journalism student here at Kettering University. I'm an engineering student, and I kind of came about being interested in science communication in kind of a roundabout way. So I was doing an internship at a large chemical company, and I was really interested because I was working with all of these super bright Ivy League educated men and women who can tell you on and on and on all of these different things about mechanisms with organic chemistry, all, you know, material scientists. But the minute you put them in a room together and want them to work together on a project, their communication always seemed to fall apart or fall flat. And I was really interested in that phenomenon because there was no reason these incredibly intelligent people couldn't communicate with each other and couldn't communicate their ideas in layman's terms to other people. And so that kind of, in a long way, got me really interested in technical communication, science communication, and how people who are heavily educated in the sciences can communicate their ideas simply to people who aren't educated. Because not everyone has to be a scientist or completely science literate, but everyone should be able to understand concepts and portray concepts to other people. So I got really interested in that and reached out to a friend at WKUF about doing a radio show about science. And she was a little nervous at first because it's kind of hard, you know, with the Kettering schedule of 11 weeks, intense coursework, to come up with a science thing to talk about every week. And I was like, no, I don't want to talk just about the science. I want to talk about how to communicate the science and why does society fail at communicating the science. So that kind of sparked my idea. And yeah, that's just really why I'm interested in science communication. It's a really interesting field. And I really wanted to talk to Sandra about how she got into her role, how, you know, different events in her life led her to this, and how, yeah, just that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we got to this radio space at Kettering University in very different ways because career in media.
Yeah.
A much longer one than you have had.
Yes.
Older. Mm-hmm. So it's fun to be back mm-hmm. on a campus. I was a journalism major at Indiana University many years ago. I grew up in suburban Chicago, and we had always spent a lot of time around the lakes, a lot of time mm-hmm. up north, as we all say, Wisconsin, Minnesota, the UP, and Michigan. And then I actually had an internship in Muskegon at the newspaper there. And
oh, neat.
I've got a job at the Associated Press in Detroit, which mm-hmm. was what brought me to Michigan many years ago, and I'm still here. And so I've worked at daily newspapers. I've worked at the wire service. I spent 5 years at Detroit Public Radio covering the bankruptcy of the city there and then what happened after. And then just over a year ago, about 15 months, I moved over to the television station. We had worked in partnership with them in something called the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, covering the bankruptcy and the revitalization of the city. To what extent it happened. So, a lot of things in that led to the position I have now. One was digital communication. You know, mm-hmm. how do we communicate? Well, whether we're a radio station or a newspaper or a magazine or a TV station, we all do digital work now. And
absolutely.
So we do all of that with Great Lakes Now to get the stories about the lakes out to, reach audiences on different platforms, whichever way they choose to consume news and best learn. So we have, like I said, we have the show, the monthly show, and we have the website. And we also have, speaking of science education, a curriculum component that we just launched. And I'm really excited about doing another 2 years of that.
Yeah, really cool. So I know a lot of our listeners out there are engineering students, are science students. So is there any way you could elaborate on the differences between, let's say, writing for a paper versus writing for TV or writing for radio?
Sure. So I think the simplest way is to always think about the audience. Who's the audience? I mean, you may have the most revolutionary research and the most amazing findings and the most complicated experiments that you've run that have broad meaning to several disciplines all over the world. But if you're trying to speak to a bigger audience, if you're trying to speak to policymakers and lawmakers and university officials who control budgets for research and getting better labs, you have to think about what they're hearing and do they really understand what you're saying?
So I'll
give an example of that. We were with a graduate student at Notre Dame a few weeks ago, and her Twitter handle is Dr. Catfish.
Katie. Love that.
Right. She's currently doing the hashtag 25 days of Fishmas. With fish.
Also love that. That's right? Fascinating.
So if we get into talking here about mm-hmm. fun science communication mm-hmm. things, that's my favorite example. But anyway, she was talking about learning some hard lessons about communicating outside of her lab. And she was talking to, I think it was a relative, and she was talking about fish, and she said dorsal fin. And the person stopped her and said, that's some fancy science talk. And she thought, everybody knows what a dorsal fin is. But mm-hmm. we all get in the lingo and the jargon and of our own industries or disciplines.
Absolutely.
And we really have to remember. So that is always my first bit of advice for people, even people who've worked in the media for a very long time. Who is your audience and how are you reaching them? And what's important to them? And to the extent that you can hear from them directly about what they're wondering, what their questions are, we don't always know. We had a saying in one newsroom I worked in where you are not the audience. We are.
Yeah. Yeah.
We, read and watch TV and listen to the radio, but we're really not the broader audience beyond the work we're doing at our own desks.
Yeah, I think that's really cool that you brought up how do you articulate these scientific viewpoints to people like politicians, people like, who work at like the grant associations, who you're trying to keep your lab afloat on grant money. And I think a lot of people are like, oh, I don't want to get my PhD because I don't want to be a grant writer for a living. And they always say, oh, I want to be doing the science. I don't want to be doing the grant writing. And to me, I guess I've always felt like, isn't that the part you should be most passionate about? You speak to your importance and you get to talk about yourself. But a lot of people dread it because I think they don't really think about who am I writing to. And they try to submit like a journal for publication as a grant proposal. So it's really, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. But I think that's really interesting. And I am super interested in science communication as a graduate program. I follow a lot of people who have attended UC's science communication master's program and have made that transition from lab science to writing. And I think it's really interesting because when I worked at least at Dow, a lot of the scientists had trouble with like articulating to the manager, this is why I need funding for X project, or this is why you need to keep me on as a scientist to work on this project. And I always thought that was just astonishing. And I always was like, oh, I wish there was someone here who could help these people, because their science is important, it is valuable, but they can't articulate it. So I think it's really cool that, you know, you have to think about your audience, you have to think about, you know, at what level can they understand, and how do I communicate this without being condescending? And like, there's a lot of like facets to that. And I'm sure working in the public domain, there's even more facets to that, for sure.
So many things. And it also depends on not only who your audience is, whether you're trying to talk about your research and its importance to get grants or to get renewed, you know, within your own institution. Sometimes you're talking about it related to policy. So you're talking to legislators and lawmakers who may or may not have any background in science. But it also depends on the medium that you're using. You know, a tweet is different than a Facebook post.
Yeah.
A radio talk show like Brain Food is different than a 45-second spot in a news.
Yeah.
A TV magazine style show on a PBS station like Great Lakes Now is very different than a CNN debate.
Yeah.
So, and a short article, you know, in a blog style format is very different than a long narrative article, like in, you know, some of the bigger nonprofit, you know, kind of publications online, a Wisconsin Watch, for example. So I think, you know, that gets a little bit overwhelming, and you just sort of have to, you know, we want to write one thing that we can then repackage. We can't always do that.
So yeah.
Those discussions are constantly going on. And I think as the scientist, I actually did a session last year, and they brought it back for this year's conference, the International Association of Great Lakes Research, IAGLAR.
Acronym. Wonderful.
The International Association of Great Lakes Research. The conference was in New York last year, and it's going to be in Winnipeg this year. And they do a SciComm track, 2 days. They do have some scholarships available, so you.
Oh, interesting.
Your students interested. But they had 2 days of sessions and workshops about science communication, and the room was a mix of scientists and people who do the communication for those institutions. And one of the workshops I did, the one they're bringing back, is actually just that. It's interviewing across the different mediums.
So okay.
If you're the scientist coming in to do a brain food talk,
yeah.
That's very different than you're doing the breaking news story, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Been published, and you want to just get out the key points of your findings, which is very different than if you're one of many voices in a big, longer article. That's just one example of the training that was out there that I've been involved in this year. But it's good to see people are interested in it, because I think, you know, some people are very nervous to speak at all.
Yeah.
But remembering, here's another tip, remembering that you're the expert about your work can help with nervousness, but you don't want to go too far on that, because like I said at the beginning, you know, making sure your audience is understanding what you're saying.
Yeah. And I think the talk is really cool. So I have a professor right now for communications course, and she specializes in technical writing and specifically does some research in science communication and, you know, how do we better educate engineering students who are usually pretty flush with their engineering coursework and are worried more so about, oh, I have to do all this CAD or all this software, and not really worried about, oh, I have a paper to write for comm. Well, I'll do that in 2 hours, and then I won't have to think about it again. And so we've definitely had some really interesting conversations where we talk about, like, how do we get people to understand that it's important to be capable of communicating your ideas, and how can we design curriculum that engages people who are more geared towards the science and engineering? So I think that's a really cool thing that you're doing with the scientists.
Well, we've actually, so this isn't science students, but we've talked with some university classes about having journalism students do stories related to the Great Lakes. We would publish them on greatlakesnow.org, but we'd kind of have a section so that people know it's student work. I mean, I think, you know, what you guys may or may not realize is some people are a little more forgiving when you're students.
Yes, for sure.
Turn, or, you know, you have the ability to be a student of something. But that also gives you the experience, you know, in getting that feedback and trying it out as well. I mean, it really is, writing is one of those things that you kind of have to do it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Take it, which is, you know, some very helpful criticism sometimes, but it's not always easy.
Yeah, I know, at least for me, I feel like I get so nervous when I turn a paper in, or I get really nervous when I'm talking on the radio, which is part of the reason I started doing the radio show, because I really want to, I think that's one of my biggest weaknesses. Like, I'm a very technical person in terms of, you know, I can do lots of math and integrals and tons of stuff that won't be so helpful in my career later, but that's fine. And I'm not so good at my soft skills, like my communication from one person to the other, or my presentation skills. I like to fiddle. I like to rotate when I talk. So this is really helping me in a way, but I think a lot of engineering students get very caught up in the stereotypes that they get placed in. So, like, a lot of, you know, engineering students are male, or engineering students are just good at math, and they're not good at this. And so I think it's really empowering to, like, help those, like, give them an incentive for being good at those things.
Well, I think too, the collaborations, multidisciplinary work is really a key now.
Absolutely.
More and more about that across disciplines, across schools, across universities, even the University Research Corridor here in Michigan brought the big three together, and they're working together across a variety of things. So thinking of it from, okay, if I have a team, you know, it's not just one researcher in the lab. How can we design work and initiatives, not just one grant-funded process, but if we're highlighting the collaborative effort, then maybe you have team members who are a little more versed in
it, yeah,
and more comfortable, and everybody has different skills. You could, by working as a team, you could put somebody forward who's more comfortable sitting in this chair, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think a lot of times here at Kettering, we don't have any sort of department. Well, we have a liberal studies department, but that's it. We have a liberal studies department. There's no English majors walking around on campus. There's no journalism majors. It's literally you are an engineering student or you are a science student. There are no other majors at this school. So we sometimes get, like, these blinders put on us when it comes to, like, I don't even know how I would communicate with someone who only takes writing classes. What? Like, that's so weird. When do they take hard classes? Like, we get very much in that, like, tunnel vision of, like, oh, well, we know we're an engineering school. And a lot of times we produce students who aren't capable of talking in front of people. And I think that sometimes really hinders us at this university. So I think it was really important for WKUF to have students do student-run shows and actually start to learn some of those soft skills. And for me, it's incentivized learning some of those soft skills because I'm proud of it. Like, I like being able to go on air and those kind of things. But yeah, Kettering is very hard to get people to, like, engage in those soft skills. So it's really kind of an interesting case study when you, like, look in on it and, like, our little dot on the map with no liberal arts education. It's so strange.
Well, I hope somebody is listening who becomes a radio host in the future. They remember this moment and they let you know about it sometime, because, you know, I think students, a lot of times young people and students, and if you're moving to Kettering from elsewhere, you don't know the opportunities that are here.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know the student activities that can translate into really valuable experience.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, employers do look for it. I don't know. I've never hired an engineering major, so I can't say that, you know, what it would look like on a resume, but I do know that if I see resumes from people, and all things being equal, if somebody has a very unique experience where they learned a little bit different skill outside of their major, I, as an employer, definitely look for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, yeah, that's important, because a lot of our extracurriculars on campus, this is a very unique extracurricular. And I know a lot of my friends are sad because we don't have a theater department and they can't do theater anymore. Or they can't do choir anymore. Or they can't play an instrument. So it's very... we're very limited, but I think that the experiences we do have and still having a small local radio station is amazing. Because I know a lot of the other schools that used to have radio stations, they get bought up. I think Malcolm was telling me once by, like, NPR will come in and, like, buy their station, and then it becomes like, well, this is a Michigan radio now, or, you know, it's not University of Michigan's own anymore. And so we have this very niche little bubble we live in where we still have a student-run, fully student-run radio station. It is really cool.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So how did you, I'm going to interview you because that's what I'm
doing. All right.
But how did you come up with the concept of doing a show on science and calling it Brain Food for your Friday night audience here?
So I am really interested in environmental science. One of the main reasons, so I used to be just a biochemistry major here. And then as I got further and further along, I realized my passion didn't lie so much in human biochemistry. It lied in environmental biochemistry. And I became really interested in the idea of environmental engineering and about conservation and all of those things altogether. So I wanted to do a show specifically heavily on science in Michigan. And a lot of Michigan science is Great Lakes oriented, environmental oriented. And so that's what I really wanted to talk about. And I always call this my screaming into the void for an hour and a half because, you know, we don't have the biggest fan base. Hi, Mom. But like, we get to, you know, I get to come here and I get to talk about things that I want to talk about. And I get to talk about science. I get to talk about global warming. And I get to talk about the Flint water crisis. And it's just become a really great way for me to, you know, find a place for my late night research when I'm bored and I read about, you know, environmental science. And then I get to come here and I get to share it with people. And it's become a really good routine for me. It's almost kind of therapeutic in a way. Like, I don't know, it's just a lot of fun. Yeah, but that's how I came up with it.
You're doing an environmental show in here in Flint, which of course has, unfortunately, for many terrible reasons, mm-hmm. been the headlines and the epicenter of water quality discussions,
yeah,
among many others, but really pushing, I mean, I think if there's a bright spot, and I don't mean this to trivialize anybody's experience in this, but, you know, Southeast Michigan, you know, we are, Great Lakes Now is a regional initiative, and we talk to people around the region and even the country about things, and Flint always comes up, and people around the country are aware of it. They know what happened.
Yeah.
It makes them examine their own communities. Mm-hmm. There's always been the funding to do it, but it really has led to a very raising the bar and raising mm-hmm. water literacy, if you will,
yeah,
of Southeast Michigan, and which, you know, it should not have happened that way, but
But it really did a good job in highlighting injustice. And I think it set a really good example for other states to look in and internally kind of, you know, rate, like, you know, how are we doing this to our citizens? Is our infrastructure outdated? Is our infrastructure going to fall apart? Are we going to put a whole socioeconomic class of people in a position where they can't afford clean water? I think it's very sad that it happened. And I, growing up in Davison, which is just 5 minutes east of here, have witnessed tons of friends and family who have struggled with it. I drank lots of it. I showered in it. Like, I have felt the effects of Flint water. So it's very sad. But in a way, I think it did a really good job of highlighting and calling out a lot of corrupt people and saying, like, we need to fix this. We need to look inwards. And it's had positives and negatives, I think.
And I think, mm-hmm. you know, me speaking as a media person, I was very impressed with the willingness of the Flint community to tell its own story.
Absolutely.
People came forward. People came on the radio. They came on TV. They appeared in documentaries. They talked to book authors. Mm-hmm. I am sure that it got weary to try to go pick up water to keep your family hydrated, bathed, fed.
Yeah.
You know, all the things you use water for. And just to be doing that basic task of life that most of us just turn on the faucet when we roll out of bed, but to having to leave your home and go do that and then have news trucks there got to be very old. But, you know, I was always, every time I've seen reports, I was up here a few times. I was very impressed by people here being willing to tell their stories, because we in the media can't do our jobs without that.
Yeah.
The heart of it. And sure, you know, sure, we can go to press conferences with high level elected officials and we get news releases, but really at the end of the day, and this comes back to the science communication, you know, mm-hmm. who it's about are people and
yeah.
residents of a community and the impact of any of these issues on them. And so I really, mm-hmm. I still commend Flint for coming forward as they do.
Yeah. And the Flint community is definitely very strong in terms of understanding, like, we went through this together and we were a whole community. There was no, you know, racial lines drawn in the community. The community was the community. It was Flint citizens that came out against it and that spoke and told their story. And I think it was really powerful to, I was in high school, in middle school when this was all going on. So I was immersed in it. And it's just very fascinating. The local politics in Flint have definitely been something that have enraged me, but also have shown me what good government can do in terms of watching local citizens volunteer at the drop-off sites for water and distribute the water and all of the free programs we have now in terms of like daycare and giving out, you know, diapers and fresh fruit to all of the Flint youth, which was really cool. I didn't know that that fruit actually helped reverse some of the effects of lead poisoning. So a lot of the local elementary schools started distributing free fruit to the children at lunchtime and for breakfast, which is really interesting. My mom is a local educator, so she was the superintendent of a district in Flint during the crisis. And it was heartbreaking, I think, for her because she didn't live in the district, but she had to watch all of the students. And I think in many ways she felt very guilty about, you know, she worked in this Flint school but didn't live in Flint and had to watch that community go through that. And there was a lot of guilt there, I think, from a lot of people. But I think it did a really good job highlighting the injustice and bringing a lot of people who maybe wouldn't have been aware and have if they had read the headline, not been aware of the injustice, not addressed it, and not really like validated it. It helped them validate it by watching their community go through it. It was a really interesting time in my life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we do still see a lot of interest in water. A lot of people that approach us wanting to know more about drinking water. You know, our program and our initiative is Great Lakes Now, but we also do water quality and drinking water quality. Mm-hmm. You can't separate those, I think.
Yeah.
We mm-hmm. all tie into the lakes for vacations or pretty views or economics or, you know, cities around. There are places to travel, but when it comes down to it, it's about water. And, you know, 40 million people live in the area, and most
yeah.
of they're drinking water from those lakes. So mm-hmm. the idea that water could be that bad, and that infrastructure that we rely on in our own communities intersects with water issues in 8 states and 2 provinces and international law. It really, you know, it's a lot.
Yeah. Well, I think it even kind of turns some people's lives upside down. Like, I think you know, for your whole childhood, you turned on the tap and water came out and you drank it. Like, water was just something you got. And when you're a child, you don't realize, oh, your parents pay the water bill. But even as a parent, okay, you know, auto takes out of your, or you turn in a check every now and then for your water, and you just think, I'll always have this. I'll always have water. It's always clean. I'll always be able to shower and run my dishwasher whenever I want. And then one day you wake up and you find out that it's been bad, or, you know, your water's been poisoning you, or, you know, there's stuff in the soil around your house that's been poisoning your water. And it's like, it's just something that it just flips everyone. It almost was like a post-apocalyptic society where water could be gone at any moment. And it's very scary and very real. And it was sudden for a lot of people, I think, to realize that that was going on in Michigan, of all places, surrounded by water.
Well, and we at Great Lakes Now, we did a documentary early this year called The Forever Chemicals, which is about PFAS mm-hmm. in Western Michigan. But so many people, when we were making that documentary, brought up parallels to Flint, or
yeah.
a different response from state government was that because of Flint, and, you know, lessons were learned from that.
Mm-hmm.
Some people raised the question whether the PFAS contaminations in more affluent and different demographics of communities had led to a quicker response, which, you know, I certainly can't answer that question, but that issue was raised and the perception was out there in communities.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, it's a different administration now, so you can't compare exactly.
Absolutely, yeah.
But mm-hmm. but there's definitely, you know, the issue of drinking water quality is not going to go away in any of our lifetimes. And it's just a matter of how much better is our science now at detecting. And I think that's the thing with lead. If we don't know everything, but we know a lot more about lead than in humans and long-term effects and even short-term effects than we do about PFAS. And,
yeah.
you know, that's something we've dug into on the show a little bit, of like, what do we know and what should we know and mm-hmm. can we know it?
Yeah, for sure. So if you are listening, to Brain Food, which is a science communication show that airs from 5:30 to 7 p.m. every Friday on WKUF LP Flint 94.3 FM. So yeah, like you were saying about the PFAS. So we did a show very early on. I think it was my second show ever on air where I talked about PFAS. And it is something that I was really interested in and fascinated by organic chemistry. So I was really interested in what is this, you know, bioaccumulation? Why is it a bioaccumulator? Why are these things so hard to break down? And I was, what are they used in? Like, why did we use them for so long? And it really, they're very tricky little molecules. They're very interesting to study, though, and they were very useful, and I understand why we use them now. You know, fire retardants and water repellency are big things for them. But it was a really cool specific to Michigan, and again, a lot of companies in Michigan that started here that resulted in it, which was really interesting. I think a lot of history, and again, even with some of the Flint, with like General Motors and AC Delco, which had manufacturing facilities in Flint, and I know at least on Kettering's campus, we have a lot out front where nothing grows, and that's leftover chemical contaminants in our soil. Then it's very interesting how many people, I don't think, know that, or maybe know that that's a problem in Flint or anywhere, really, where there's been a large manufacturing facility.